pleasure to welcome back to Communacopia in our 25th year, Randall Stephenson, the Chairman and CEO of AT&T. Randall, welcome back.
Thanks, Brett.
All right. So during your second quarter conference call, your CFO, John Stephens, spent some time reviewing the company's strategy, which he described as to be the world's premier integrated communications company. And so I wanted to start off by asking, what are the key trends that you're seeing unfolding in the industry that has driven AT&T to pursue an integrated business model?
Okay. If I could, I have a safe harbor comment. I need to make comments of forward-looking projections. They may be subject to risk. Results may differ materially. Details can be found in our SEC filings and on our website. And one last item. We are involved in the 600 MHz government auction right now, so I won't be able to address any questions on that. So pardon for the digression. Integrated communications. Look, we made a commitment a few years ago that we said, if you're going to be successful long-term in this industry, you're going to have to come with a full integrated suite of capabilities to succeed. And as you think about what are the trends that lead you down that path, the place I go first is to the business segment. And if you're not that familiar with our business, we're $160 billion plus in revenue, and it's a fairly even split between consumer and business segments. And I think the business segment is the place where you see this most obviously. And think about what's going on in networking. A lot of the trends people have been saying are going to drive us to a place where just commoditized pipes, dumb pipes, as people like to refer to them, will be what you're selling. And I would say the most surprising trend is we're seeing anything but that. That is not playing out. And if you kind of think through the big drivers of networking and what is behind that, you kind of get an understanding as to why. The first big driver, the one that we're seeing at the greatest scale, is cloud. And cloud is finally here, right? We've been talking about this forever. The cloud is scaled, it is material, it's significant, and it's driving huge networking requirements. And what we're finally seeing is companies are gaining the confidence and conviction that they're starting to put mission-critical applications into these public clouds, into Amazon, into Microsoft Azure. And when you put mission-critical applications in there, you're putting mission-critical data in there as well. And if you're a CIO or a CEO, the thing you worry most about is security in that environment. And we started a number of years ago developing a product called NetBond. We said, we're not going to compete in this commoditized cloud. We actually, the cloud is what's being commoditized. It's not the network. We said, what we need to do is ensure that our customers can get from their mobile handset through the network into the cloud, back out without ever touching the public internet. And we developed a product called NetBond. Basically, this is virtual private networking into and out of the cloud. And every major cloud provider is NetBonded to AT&T's network, whether it's Microsoft or Amazon. The volumes on this are exploding. NetBond connections just this year over last year are up 4x. And here's another important data point, though. Connections are up 4x. The traffic over those connections is up 8x. That tells you what the intensity of traffic is doing within this. So it is mission-critical applications going in there. So this is a managed service for the networking attached to the cloud. And by the way, going in and out of the cloud, if you put a mission-critical application in the cloud, you can't tolerate and you don't afford latency. You have to have high quality of services. So quality of service commitments are critical in these environments. That requires virtual private networking. So all of the managed network services that people have been saying are going to be commoditized out, it's actually going the opposite direction. Security, quality of service. As you think about businesses consuming more and more video, they are being video-driven. Training is being delivered over video. Video conferencing is exploding. Security, quality of service. Virtual private networking connections are critical here as well. And it's surprising, but even voice is fitting into this category. As people move all their voice to IP, this is where you really think just big dumb pipes. No. Voice quality is critical. VPN is being the primary underlying transport underneath voice. And then we haven't even talked about IoT. And in the world of IoT, this is getting very exciting. This is kind of where cloud was about three or four years ago. We've been talking about it, and it's just now taking off. But the Internet of Things, companies are connecting everything to these networks. Cars, health monitoring. I mean, we're even talking about voting booths being connected as connected devices. if you're a CEO or a CIO, you cannot have that kind of traffic traversing over the public internet. Here we go again. Even the wireless connectivity for Internet of Things has to be a managed network connection, quality of service. Connected cars, you can't have a lot of latency on connected cars. Autonomous cars, latency is just it's a really bad thing. So managed network services and security continue to be in play. And so as we step back from all of this, we ask, is it even conceivable that you can deliver in a world of these kind of requirements without a fully integrated suite of products and services? And this is why we think the integrated communications company is so critical. You have to have mobility. You have to have virtual private networking. You have to have fixed broadband. You have to have security solutions. And if you can bring all that to market, then you can address these needs we're talking about. And we haven't even discussed yet consumer. The consumer side, it's a little more straightforward, but the consumer is about one thing. It's about video. And we're seeing them consume more video than they have ever consumed. And they're consuming the video across multiple platforms and multiple devices. And here's the value proposition that we think it's critical that we solve. And that is the consumer has gotten to a place where they're not terribly happy about paying multiple times for the same content. And what I mean by this is they don't like buying a DirecTV subscription and then having to go pay extra if they want to see that same data on a mobile device or on a tablet. They don't want to buy an over-the-top subscription and have to pay for it again if they want to stream it to a TV. And if they forget to DVR Silicon Valley, the idea that I now have to go to Apple or Hulu or wherever I'm going to go and download it and pay for it again when I've already paid for it on DirecTV, we have to solve that problem. We think we're to a place where we have resolved this for the customer across several segments here. Again, at the consumer level, if you want to solve that problem, premium content availability, mobility, fixed broadband, linear TV, we think you need all of that to compete long-term in this space. So the assets that we've assembled, we think, get us there. We bought DirecTV because you have to have a premium content package if you want to compete here. DirecTV, we are the largest TV provider in the United States. We have been very aggressive over the last year accumulating the content rights to distribute the content across all platforms. We have TV Everywhere up now. It is up and running. It is a very robust platform. If you subscribe to DirecTV, you can consume that content wherever you want, on any screen that AT&T offers, a tablet, a smartphone, wherever. We are very close. In the fourth quarter, we will launch DirecTV Now. This is exclusively an over-the-top product. This is no set-top box. This is no truck roll. This is a customer pulling down an app, getting a very robust platform. We'll be rolling it out in a couple of months. This is an exciting product. We're talking 100-plus channels at a very, very aggressive price point. And when you buy this content, the data required to stream it on your mobile device is incorporated into the price of the content. So we think that's really important to have the premium content package available. We think it's also important that you have a mobile asset and that you have a mobile asset that is high quality with capacity to last you for a long time. We anticipate our customers are going to become very acclimated to consuming this content on their mobile devices. It's why we've been so aggressive at acquiring spectrum. We have 40 megahertz of spectrum that is fallow, waiting to be put to use over the next few years as our consumers begin to consume more and more video on their mobile devices. We're extending this capability all the way down into Mexico, which we're really excited about. We have a robust IP broadband platform past 60 million homes in the U.S. And so you put it all together, we think having this fully integrated capability and going to market with it is going to be unique for a long time.
All right, a lot of follow-up questions.
I bet you do.
I
thought we covered it all. Can we just quit?
Still got a few minutes left. DirecTV Now, you brought it up. You said you'll be coming to market with a very aggressive price point. When we think about these over-the-top services, particularly companies trying to create MVPD-like experiences, the math that we have trouble with as analysts is that the programming is expensive. And so getting to an aggressive price point in the market suggests very thin margins. And so I was hoping you could walk us through how you determine that this is the right pricing strategy for this product, and then I got a couple of follow-ups on that.
Sure. MVPD-like product. So think 100 premium channels in a purely over-the-top platform with a completely different cost structure. I mean, this is a very unique cost structure and a very unique platform. We have built this from the ground up. We spent the last year plus developing this platform. And it starts with how does the customer subscribe to the service? They download an app on their smartphone, their smart TV, or their tablet. They subscribe purely digitally. They select their content digitally. They interact with us digitally. The billing is purely an online billing arrangement. This is a very, very low-cost customer acquisition product. It is a very low-cost-to-install product, meaning the customer has just done it once they downloaded the app. There are no set-top boxes. There are no truck rolls involved in this. So we have kind of re-platformed all of the cost for this product, and it's a very, I mean, nominal incremental cost to provision this. So to your point, we had to acquire content rights. And being the largest scale TV provider in the U.S. gave us a lot of opportunity to get a best-in-class cost structure around this content. We've been very aggressive about this over the last year, and we've been doing what I would consider some win-win arrangements with the content providers. The content providers, I believe, are. I've heard Bob Iger refer to it, that he's happy with the arrangement we struck. And so you put the different cost structure, kind of a unique position on content cost together, and we can put together a product that is, I'm going to call it thinner, not thin margins, but thinner than what we're accustomed to. But I'm always willing to take thinner margins when there is low capital intensity in the product. So we think we're going to be able to meet a price point that's very, very aggressive in the marketplace. And keep in mind, it's a product that is integrated with our wireless service, and it's also integrated with our broadband, our home broadband service. And so to the extent that it's driving additional penetration or further penetration in wireless or driving churn down in wireless, the lifetime value of a customer with this kind of product is actually quite attractive and very positive. So that's why we're so excited about it.
And so you're basically saying the return on capital is still very high because there's so little capital you need to deploy, even if you are getting a thinner margin on that service specifically.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And maybe just help us understand when you say that the connectivity is integrated, meaning regardless of whether I get my normal wireless access from one of your competitors or not, when I pay that attractive price for DIRECTV Now, if I choose to use that in a mobile environment, you're saying that I'm not going to have to pay for that connectivity?
If you choose to use that in a mobile environment on AT&T, your data costs associated with it is incorporated into your content costs.
Got it. And you mentioned that there were some win-wins with the programmers. Could you maybe dig into that a little more? What are they getting by agreeing to do this with you?
So most of the programmers are still trying to figure out the new model as well. And I would tell you one of the key variables, if you're anybody in this industry that you want, is the viewership data. And we have, I believe, the best viewership data in the industry. We have millions and millions of homes with set-top boxes that are connected to the internet, and we're able to get some anonymized viewership data that is very instructive to how you think about new advertising models, addressable advertising models. And this data is also quite instructive in terms of how you think about developing programming. And so finding ways to both parties be able to have access to that data, we think is very, very important.
Got it. Scaling has been one of the issues investors have worried about with these OTT products. It seems like some of the ones that are out there already, when they do live events, they crash. And so the first question would be, can you talk about how confident you are that you can scale this from a technology standpoint? And then just, I think I know the answer, is there anything in your content agreement? Sometimes there's content agreements where you can't have more than so many millions of subs on a package that's non-traditional. Is that a factor you have to worry about?
So scaling, we feel really good about our ability to scale this kind of product. And you do read and experience some scenarios where some premium programming hits. It's timely, and people want to be viewing it real time, and it causes some user experiences that are less than acceptable. Time will tell. We think we're demonstrating with our TV Everywhere product right now our ability to scale this. The platform that the NFL Sunday Ticket rides on is an AT&T platform. last week, if you looked at the number of people streaming the NFL Sunday Ticket, just week over week, it was up 60%, which is a stunning number. One week to the next, the number of people streaming the NFL Sunday Ticket on a mobile device was up 60%. I was one of those, by the way. I used the devil out of it while I'm watching the Dallas Cowboys play, and I'm watching all the other NFL games. The experience is really good. The experience is robust. Can we continue to scale it more and more? Can we, rather than thinking about hundreds of thousands of subscribers, millions of subscribers on this? Yeah, we do. We have a high degree of confidence in this. And where I believe we are unique is that this experience from the handset through the network to the CDN to the ingestion of the content, end to end, we own it, all right? This is kind of what we do, all right? And we have a fairly high degree of confidence that we have built a platform here for our over-the-top platform and our TV Everywhere platform that we can scale. And we can scale in a very robust experience. We're not trying to do something where you just get buffer fatigue while you're waiting on content. We want this to be an MVPD-like, your word, MVPD-like experience on a mobile device. And we feel pretty good we're going to be able to pull that off.
In terms of getting this into the market, you've talked about doing it in the fourth quarter. What's still left to get done? Do you have all the content rights that you need, and in particular, broadcasters, are they on board?
Yeah. So we're probably, I mean, this is a rough number, but we're 90% there on content agreements. There's a couple of key ones that we're still working on, but we are largely there. You've seen the ones that we've gotten. Disney is done. HBO is done. NBCUniversal. You can go down to Discovery. We've got all of these major content agreements done. We're, like I said, a couple of holdouts that we're still trying to grind through and work through. But from a content standpoint, we're very close to being ready. What's basically taking the extra time is the platform. We want the platform to be right, and we don't want the situation that you just talked about. So we'll enter into the market kind of slowly, getting thousands of friendlies on, make sure that we see how the product is scaling, and try to get ourselves ready into the fourth quarter to launch in a more significant way. I think 2017, this is going to be a big, big driver of video for us.
Last question on this. How do you make sure that you're not going to cannibalize your existing video product with DIRECTV Now?
I find this one funny because I oftentimes get asked, "Do you really think there's a market for this?" And I always say, "Yeah, I'm convinced there's a market for this." They say, "Well, are you afraid it's going to cannibalize your existing product?" I say, "Well, it's one or the other, right?" And I do think, yeah, that there is risk of it cannibalizing the existing product. I think that, though, is a good sign. The worst thing we can do, and I've been doing this 34 years, where we launch products that are disruptive in the marketplace, and if you don't see them threatening your legacy product sets, 99 times out of 100, it doesn't go anywhere. And so what you're always looking for within your organization is a concern of cannibalizing existing product sets. That means you have found something that the market really, really wants. I would tell you, I think we have demonstrated a real competence at managing these types of market and technology transitions. We had this same conversation for how many years about wireless. The better wireless service got, the more people said, "Oh, you're going to cannibalize your wireline product set," right? We had the same thing with VPN. It's going to cannibalize your traditional transport and so forth. I think we're pretty good at managing these. Out of the gate, the DIRECTV Now over-the-top product is going to be targeted, very specifically targeted at those 20 million homes that have no pay TV subscription today. That's a big population. We think a significant number of those would like a 100-plus channel pay TV subscription if it were at a very, very attractive price point. And so we're going to go after those 20 million first. We'll be selling this product with limited streams, one or two streams. And so think about up-market, most of you in this room. You need multiple streams into your home. These are people living in apartments with one or two screens in their home, a tablet or a smartphone and a TV on the wall. That's where they'll want to stream this. So one or two streams, we think you can kind of manage the cannibalization in the short run. But in the long run, if this is an attractive product, this is one of those we'll continue to work it and work the pricing and work the mechanism, but we think this is going to be really important for quite a period of time.
Great. Let's talk a little about wireless. You know, your first half numbers suggest you're managing the competitive environment pretty well, particularly things like churn rates. Yet investors are constantly worried about a potential uptick in competition. Comcast yesterday is talking about getting into the wireless space through their MVNO agreement with Verizon at some point next year. It seems like there's been some frenzied behavior around the launch of the iPhone 7. You know, from where you sit, how do you feel about the competitive environment, and do you feel that it's shifting quickly?
No, I don't see it shifting. Brian's comment yesterday from Comcast about they're gonna put the hammer down on wireless, you can look at that a couple of ways. Is that an increase in competitive intensity? Maybe. Or is it a validation of what we're trying to do? Is it a validation that a integrated solution is important in the marketplace? We think it is a validation of what it is we're trying to accomplish here. As you think about wireless competition, I have a hard time just talking about wireless competition, you know, under a broad umbrella. We don't think about it that way. This industry has gotten really sophisticated in segmenting the market down. You know, our growth in wireless is coming over 100% from business customers. Here again, we're having an incredible amount of success selling mobility along with security, along with NetBond. I mean, you walk into a business location, and if you just are selling mobility or just selling broadband, you're a bit limited in the product set that you can offer. We're walking in with a full suite of products, and we're having a lot of success in business in terms of mobility. The growth is nice and robust on the business segment with mobility. Churn is really low in the business segment on mobility for all the reasons I just articulated. The next segment we focus on is the high-end consumer. In the high-end consumer, everything we have just talked about is focused towards the high-end consumer. This is why when, as soon as we closed DIRECTV, we said we need to go out and lock down our customers who are DIRECTV and AT&T mobility subscribers, and we gave, you know, gave them access to unlimited data. 5 million customers very quickly moved onto that integrated offer. That is a low churn proposition. That's a high lifetime value customer, and that's how we're competing. It is a video-centric mobility integrated strategy on the high end. Then I've lost track of time. Three years ago, I think, we bought Cricket. Cricket is where we are competing aggressively down market, and this is where we're competing aggressively on price. It's a very different cost structure. It's a very different customer care structure, and our customers are loving it. We're getting people to migrate from feature phones at $35 a month up to smartphones on Cricket at $41 a month. Our Net Promoter Scores in this segment, they're our highest in the company, surprisingly, all right? We're doing quite well down at that end of the market. In fact, we've added almost 900,000 subscribers first half of the year down at that segment. That's kinda how we view it. I would tell you, if you just now step back from it, what are we seeing? I mean, you put that kind of approach to the market together, and we have ARPUs growing, we have churn stable, and we have margins expanding. You know, the equation feels right to us. I mean, yeah, competitive intensity, it kinda wanes. You have a new iPhone, competitive intensity is going to spike for a period of time. Bottom line, I like how we're going at the market right now.
Investors worry when they see unlimited plans because they think it's gonna tax your network. You have your competitors saying that networks aren't differentiated anymore, and it's not a decision factor. How do you think about the position of AT&T's network versus competitors? After that, I wanna get into some of the stuff you're doing on SDN.
Sure. Look, to say that networks aren't differentiated, service is differentiated. I mean, you gotta be clear about this, right? It starts with network. You better have a high-quality network experience. If you want to be a premium quality player, you start there. I mean, it's kinda like saying, you know, I wanna be in the automobile business, and I wanna be at the luxury end. I want the quality end of the automobile business. You don't just build a quality car and stop there. You build a quality car, you surround it with a quality retail experience where you sell the automobile, you surround it with a quality repair and maintenance structure. It's the same in this industry. We've built a quality network, a high reliability, a great footprint, and then we surrounded that with a best-in-class retail experience. In fact, J.D. Power just said, number one retail experience, high-quality, high-touch retail experience. We have a high-quality online experience. J.D. Power just said, AT&T, number one on the online digital experience. A high-quality care experience. Guess what J.D. Power just said? Our care experience. You've got to have a quality experience. It starts with the network, but it has to go through every facet of the business. And so that's what we've tried to build here. And so we feel pretty good about that.
So getting to the other investments you're making, you've talked a lot about software-defined networking, virtualization. Can you please frame for us, you know, what you're trying to do with the network, where you're trying to get it to from both a capability and a cost standpoint?
Sure. Look, software-defined networking, you got to be a telecom geek to have any appreciation for the significance of what's happening here. And this, you know, this isn't a new iPhone and this kind of thing. This is not the glitzy kind of thing. This is radical in terms of what this is doing to networking and telecommunications. We have been driving this. We've been the leader in this for the last couple of years, and it is beginning to manifest itself in terms of cost, in terms of speed to market and capabilities and so forth. And so what is software-defined networking, and why should you care? You know, Ralph De La Vega, who runs our enterprise business side, does a great job explaining this in really basic terms, and that is, how many of you still carry a pen light on your keychain, a flashlight? Anybody in here carrying a pocket calculator? Of course not, right? Anybody in here that still carries a separate camera around with them? Of course not, because they're all apps on this device. They are all software-based applications residing on this device, and so all that other hardware has gone away. In networking, it's the exact same thing, okay? It is becoming a software-defined capability. And if you're a CIO, the idea that you would go out and buy hardware and put on your premise for a firewall, those days are numbered. That is nothing but an app that resides in the network. If you want a web accelerator, you're not going to go buy new hardware and put on your premise for a web accelerator. That is an app that is derived out of the network. It's the same concept, okay? And so we are literally virtualizing the core network. And as you virtualize the core network, meaning separate the software element from the hardware element, the cost implications to this are profound. What happened when we did this in the data center? When you separated the software and the hardware, what happened to the cost structure of running a data center? Those costs dropped, and they dropped dramatically. We're talking 50-60% costs to virtualize a data center. You do this in the network, we are seeing the exact same potential here to drop costs by that magnitude, and we are already realizing this. And this is a big driver of what has our cost curve, I like to call it, it's on the run, okay? I've been doing this 34 years. And in an environment of growth, which is where we are, traffic is growing, subscribers are growing, video consumption is growing. I have never in my 34 years, outside of a recession, been in a situation where I like to call the big iron costs, the network costs, the IT costs, are actually going down. This is a multi-billion-dollar cost structure, driving more and more volumes, receiving more and more volumes, and our network, our IT, our big iron costs are actually declining on a year-over-year basis, and it's been doing this for several quarters now. We don't see an end to this over the next few quarters. This is dramatic, all right? This is really, really exciting stuff in telecom. Like I said, you got to be a bit of a gearhead to have an appreciation for this. But this is exciting, and not only is it exciting from a cost structure standpoint, but it's exciting in terms of what it does in terms of speed to market with capabilities. This NetBond product that I spoke about earlier, you can't do that outside of software-defined networking. Customers are now going out and buying Ethernet services, VPN services. When you buy a NetBonded service, what's the first thing the customer does? Generally, within 30 to 60 days, they need more speed. Software-defined network, how do they get more speed? They go to their portal, 60 seconds later, they have more speed. This is what SDN, software-defined network, facilitates. We think it's significant.
And you think about the bending of the cost curve. We started off talking about the importance of being an integrated operator. Do you think that because of the integrated nature of your networks and the scale that you have on a national level and actually beyond is a competitive advantage, not just because of what you can do with products, but because of how you can price them based on your cost structure?
Yeah. Look, once you, in this industry, if you can achieve scale and manage scale and complexity, it's a massive competitive advantage, we believe. And we believe that we're on a path to, in virtually every category of cost, be at a cost advantage in the industry. And you think about the new world we're in of video, we feel really strong that we are going to have a competitive cost structure, a best-in-class cost structure around the largest element, and that's content. I mean, the synergies that we're generating in terms of content by virtue of the DIRECTV acquisition are significant. And so we're going to have a cost structure advantage on content by virtue of scale. By virtue of integration of all of these network capabilities, everything from the wireless access points to the software-defined networking, all the way through to the fixed broadband capability, we are on a path, we're pretty confident in this, that the cost to deliver a megabyte of data, we're going to have the lowest cost our target is in the world. That is the mission we're on, and we actually think we have line of sight to making that happen. What are the elements of doing that? Software-defined networking is critical. That's a huge piece of it. The other piece is we've invested a lot of money in spectrum. And having a large portfolio of spectrum, think 40 megahertz of undeployed spectrum right now, that is a massive cost structure advantage as you move forward. That gives you a much more elegant network build capability. So cost per megabyte delivered, we think will be lowest in the world. Distribution costs, I could go on, back office costs, all of these leverage scale. And so we are on a path to be in a best-in-class cost structure, a best-in-class integrated full solution set, whether it's the consumer or the business, so a premium solution set, a premium network experience with a low cost structure. We think that's a pretty powerful combination.
You mentioned your 40 megahertz of unused spectrum. How do you think about the runway you have from a spectrum capacity standpoint and frame it maybe either in years or potentially 4G versus 5G? Where do you get to with your existing portfolio?
So we feel really good that we have a number of years. I'm not going to give you exact timeline, but we have a number of years of capacity here to handle the growth in video that we believe is inevitable. I mean, it's 60% week-over-week consumption of NFL Sunday Ticket. That number just is dramatic, okay? And we don't think NFL Sunday Ticket, as people get acclimated to these new experiences. And by the way, why are people watching the NFL Sunday Ticket so much more in the digital environment on a tablet? The user interface is really, really good. We're really proud of this. And if you're watching the Giants game and you see over here that the Bengals game is tightening up, you just push the Bengals game, and now you're watching the Bengals game. And it's just a very elegant, it's a very beautiful user interface. We think this is going to continue to drive this kind of video traffic. And so we're just continuing to push. I'm sorry, the original question was, I got
timeline for the spectrum.
Oh, it's timeline. So as you think about this kind of video consumption, we believe we have several years of spectrum availability on the current network architecture to accommodate this. What we are working aggressively on now is the 5G, getting the standard set, getting the network configuration set so that we're thinking 2019, 2020, 5G can actually intercept the current LTE network infrastructure. And so, you know, if you have enough traditional spectrum capacity to get you well into the 2020 decade, 5G intercepts, and we feel like we've got a lot of runway to continue to handle the kind of volume that we're talking about here in terms of video consumption.
So you can begin launching mobile 5G using the spectrum resources you have today?
Yeah, we'll deploy 5G in some of the existing spectrum, but obviously millimeter wave is going to be important to us as well.
Okay. Verizon's talked a lot about 5G, and they're talking about it first in terms of let's go out of our region and be a fixed broadband provider by leveraging the fiber we're deploying nationwide for our LTE network. Do you agree that's a viable business model? Is it something AT&T is likely to pursue?
Yeah, look, I think we're our default or target network architecture in the long run is wireless. We think that's where we need to be. Obviously, fiber is going to be important for several years. But as we look out in a world of 5G, our target architecture is a wireless architecture. And we're thinking we need to have 1 gig type capabilities in a wireless environment. That's achievable. We feel really good that that's achievable. We think it's achievable at cost points that are relevant, at cost points that it could be a legitimate substitute for fixed broadband. And so you should assume that we're all kind of thinking about this way. Once you begin believing that you can get a gig, standardized gig speeds on wireless infrastructure, then it is a wireline substitute.
If that works out the way you anticipate, then we're not going to be thinking about AT&T as being national wireless, national video, half the country broadband. There may, in fact, be a model for you to take an integrated product solution to the whole country over time.
I will be sorely disappointed if that is not the reality two years from now.
All right. So let's talk about incentives to invest. And regulators tend to influence those decisions quite a bit. I think it's fair to say that the current regulators have been quite ambitious. And we're going to see.
We got Jonathan Adelstein in here. Do you agree with that, Jonathan? Yeah.
We're going to see a change in the people at the regulators one way or the other, regardless of how these elections work out. And so you're going to have an opportunity to restart the conversation. What do you want to say to them?
Look, there's been something profound happen this year that causes us to think more about who the chairman of the FCC or any bureaucracy is than probably a business person should be thinking. And what I mean by that is what happened was the FCC was committed to seeing broadband, the internet, and wireless brought under the purview of full regulation by the FCC. Now, what the industry said was the letter of the law is pretty clear about this. Congress's intent, it wasn't ambiguous in the law. It was really clear that those services are not to be regulated. Statutorily, they are not to be regulated. To the FCC's credit, they found a very clever way, a really clever legal position to get those brought underneath the purview of the FCC and by virtue of Title II. It was a very clever legal maneuver. It goes to court, and we thought the court filing was really, really good. We felt pretty good about it going into the courts. But it's obvious the D.C. Circuit Court now is a majority Democrat. And as a result, the court ruling basically said that they were deferring completely to the regulator. The letter of the law is clear, but they were deferring to the regulator in this matter. And so the law of the land now is that these are under Title II. These are regulated. The wireless and the internet is regulated by the FCC. Why is that so important? It's important because what we have just demonstrated is that the individual who is chairman of the FCC kind of has somewhat ultimate rulemaking authority under this kind of guise and under this kind of purview. And so we are all now, to your question, focused on who will be the next chairman of the FCC because that is so relevant. How does that person think about regulation of these services? Because how that person thinks about regulation of these services is important because they now have the full authority to regulate privacy. They have the authority to regulate pricing of business broadband, which there's a docket now going to regulate business broadband pricing. And so as you start to make capital investment decisions over the next 3 or 4 years, it's hard to make those decisions until you know who is sitting in that chair as chairman of the FCC because that will determine how these services and these investments are regulated in the foreseeable future. So it was a profound change that happened this last year, and it's one that I think is very important to all of us in business.
I mean, how profound can this be on your CapEx budget? Does the board get paralyzed to some extent waiting to see how this plays out?
I have never been in a situation where my board was more active in discussing capital allocation by virtue of who is the regulator. The regulator is very determinative in terms of how my board thinks about capital investment and capital allocation.
Got it. You've always provided an interesting perspective on the economy. And, we've been in an expansion now for 7 years. It's been a slow one, but it's been a consistent one. And so from where you sit, are you seeing headwinds or tailwinds in the economy?
Some people have said, "Man, you're pretty good at estimating the economy." And I said, "No, I just say 2% year in and year out." And if you just say 2%, you're going to be really close to being right. I was biased on the low end for 3 or 4 years, and now I'm biased on the high end for the last year. And we are kind of at a 2% growth rate scenario. I question how sustainable 2% is when business is investing at as low a level as we are investing. And fixed investment as a percentage of GDP in this country is running as low as it has run since World War II. And if you don't get business investment, you don't get productivity. If you don't get productivity, you don't get wage growth. And this is just a compounding effect. And I think this is all it backs into why 2% growth. And then so the question you have to ask is, why is business investment so low? We've spent too much time already talking about regulation. Regulation, you heard me talk about it. My board is talking about regulation and capital allocation. That is not stimulative to capital investment. Our tax regime is not stimulative to capital investment. And so if you ask me to forecast, you know, where are we headed over the next year or two, I don't see a trigger for more capital investment. I don't see much indication of tax reform, business tax reform coming. And so I think somebody would be hard-pressed to say what's going to drive productivity, what's going to drive wage growth, and therefore what's going to drive more GDP growth. You're hard to find the triggers on it. And so I'm kind of a mindset that we are stuck, best case, in a 2% scenario for the next couple of years. And hopefully, you know, we get an election behind us and get all the silliness, and one of the two candidates will go hard after a tax reform agenda. I think that is more important than anything else to getting this economy moving at greater than 2%.
All right, we have just a few minutes left, so I'll ask you my last question. A year from now, at the 26th Communicopia, what are we going to be talking about with AT&T? What do you think your biggest accomplishments will have been over the last year, and what do you think you'll be most optimistic about going forward?
I think if we execute the way I envision we execute, you're going to be really pestering me about cannibalization of traditional video with an over-the-top product. And how concerned are we about that? I think we have something here that's going to find a sweet spot in the market, and managing this technology transition and service transition is going to be a big deal for us. I also think this, what that will manifest is what a truly integrated suite of services looks like. And I don't mean bundles. I actually hate the word bundles. I don't like that. I want a product set where the customer is maybe even a bit ambivalent about what they're buying. I'm buying content. I'm buying premium content from DirecTV, and incorporated in that is my wireless data plan, all right? That is a truly integrated product set. The same thing on, we call it data-free TV everywhere. You buy a DirecTV subscription in your home, multi-linear stream subscription, high definition, 4K, getting that experience across your wireless device, and you're not thinking about the data consumption. That is a truly integrated experience. And so I think next year we'll be seeing this begin to come to life. It'll be far more apparent to you. We're starting to see the early signs of it. And what we're seeing early is really exciting and really encouraging. But I think next year you'll begin to see the true signs of it, and I think it's going to be a fun time next year.
All right, we're out of time. Randall, thanks so much.
Thank you, Brett. Appreciate it.